Well, here we are back once again for classic movies with a film I think is quite fitting, which I'll get into a little bit. I've been enjoying the lovely, spectacular spring weather there. I've got nobody in the chat. I say that we're live, but there's absolutely, I don't know if I've closed it by accident or whatever. But it's like it's just us three sitting here. All right, we've got some people watching. Hello in the chat. Is anybody then? Here we go. Look at this. They're pouring in, absolutely pouring in now. So today we're going to, you can always count on the classic movies regulars. They never let us down. We all know this isn't like chuck it into the algorithm at peak. Clickbait, you know what I mean? I know this is just for the love of the game. This is just for the love of babbling on about obscure films and staying away for the limelight. So shuffle in and put your feet up and enjoy this review of Gallipoli. We don't have to worry about what's going on in the outside world or what's hot on the algorithm. This is anti-algorithm classic movies. So I am, of course, here with Endeavor, who, as always, how are you doing, Endeavor?
I'm doing great. Great to be here.
And we've got returning for, I think, is this the second or third time, Ian Duke?
I think it's the third time, because we did Zulu or Master and Commander before.
Yeah, and as was pointed out just before the stream, this is another Peter Weir film, who also did Master and Commander. I'm just looking at his roster there. All of his films are good. Australian director, he did The Truman Show, and a weird classic called Picnic at Hanging Rock, which... I've got a feeling there's all kinds of sort of deep esoteric things in that, which I want to dig in. I always mean to look more into Picnic at Hanging Rock. But anyway, today we are going to have a look at Gallipoli. It's kind of a bit of a forgotten film, I think. An early Mel Gibson film. And it's set in World War One, and it's also the day after... Today is the day after Anzac Day. Have you got anything to say about Anzac Day, Duke?
Yeah, one thing that I found quite hopeful, actually, is that a lot of the Anzac Day services, they're now having welcomes to country, which is an Aboriginal thing. A lot of white Australians were booing it this year, which I thought was quite hopeful, actually, because it's really got nothing to do with Anzac Day. You know, so-and-so tribe supposedly lived here 200 years ago, you know, big deal.
Yeah, I don't see what that's got to do with it at all. I'm out of the loop on the internal, because it's as if they're trying to kind of wokeify something, which is an explicit sort of hat tip to the British Empire, which seems... sort of paradoxical and weird.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about that, but we can save it for later.
All right. So a little bit of sort of personal history with Gallipoli was that. So what we do, what this movie's really, you can basically carve it up into three distinct sort of parts or chapters, if you like, or acts. And then what it's about is you follow two young Australian men to the backdrop of World War One, and they're making their way. They're both great runners, and what I like about it is that you see Australia in 1914, is it, and or 15? That's bad.
It would be 1915.
Yeah.
Well, it starts off in 1914, but they don't actually get into action until 1915. So, yeah.
Yeah. And what you do is see Australia, like, I just think it looks perfect. I think it looks like paradise on earth. It's sort of peak. I mean, we've talked about this a lot, where when you get the era just before World War One, it's, I think it's like peak Western civilization. And you see the good manners, and everybody's dressed properly, and everybody's got a sense of propriety. And it's, again, it's that theme where you're heading into, like, you know, the iceberg, quite literally, because the Titanic was around this era. And you've got all of this, like, ominous symbolism. It's something that's a recurring theme on classic movies, on the films that we've covered. And here you see it with what you don't normally see, which is Australia as this kind of, I'll say it bluntly, like, white paradise. And it just looks wonderful. And what they are, basically, they're going to sign up to the war. They're going to go into there's a horse regiment. And the other, Mel Gibson doesn't, though. I mean, I think we'll come on to that later. That he's got nothing but contempt for it all, but I've got a feeling we'll get into that a little bit later on. But then there's this long scene where they're traveling across the desert. Now, when I hadn't seen this since I was like a little boy, but what I remembered from Gallipoli was them just walking. I remember this being a film, sort of, because I hadn't seen it for maybe 30 years. And what I remembered about it was them, it seemed like a film where people would spend like 2 hours just running and walking, like walking through deserts, running through the outback, running through a small town, walking here, walking there. That's all I remembered of the movie. And then when I watched it again last week, and then I sort of had it on again last night, it actually is like that. It actually is like that. But I do think it works. It's unusual because you expect them to get to the front lines within, let's say, half an hour, and then you can have 2 hours of war. And it isn't like that at all. It's like a long, long walk. But I think I do actually, when I watched it again, like I watched it a few weeks ago, and then I watched it again, it was all, sort of on in the background again last night. I kind of got it. I kind of got what Peter Weir was trying to do, because you're completely invested in the characters. And then in the second part, they go to Egypt. They've signed up. They're in the army, but they get split apart. And then they go to Egypt for their training. And it's, you get a good insight into Egypt at the time. And it looks a total dump. Like, I mean, there's no really any kind of romanticism about it at all. And then they've got the pyramids in the background, of course. And then in the third section, they actually arrive at the battle. They get to Gallipoli. They get to the where the film's named after, and the slaughter that was taking place there. And all in all, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But it is a slow mover. What did you two think of it?
Well, what I'll say is that I actually really enjoyed the film, too. Yeah, it's not your typical war movie, so the war actually just comes in towards the end of the film. But what I really like about this movie, Gallipoli, is the way that it captures Australia as this young nation and what the First World War and particularly the Gallipoli campaign meant to them. It is a very emotional film in that regard, and it's easy to see why the campaign meant so much to Australia. And I guess it resonates with me as well, because the First World War plays a very similar role in Canada's national consciousness. So I did really like that about the film. And also, I mean, it's Mel Gibson, who we always enjoy on classic movies.
Yeah, of course, the Newfoundland Regiment actually fought at Gallipoli. So there were some Canadians there. Yeah, there were some Canadians there. The Blue Puttees, they fought Gallipoli before they went to France. One thing I'd mention is that, like, the two chaps in it, Mel Gibson's character is kind of like a working class lad. That's why they get split up, is because he can't ride a horse, if I remember rightly, because they joined the Australian Light Horse, who, of course, fought on foot in Gallipoli because there's nowhere to use cavalry there. It's all rocks and hills and shit like that, you know. Whereas the other chap, who I can't remember the actor's name now, he is supposed to be more of a middle class type of fella. He comes from a bit more money.
Yeah, and it's made evident. It should be pointed out as well, like the they're both great runners, but the young blonde lad, it's terrible. I feel like I've really flunked this because I don't know his name. I don't know the actor either.
The actor's name was Mark Lee, and the character's name was Archie, and Mel Gibson's character's name was Frank.
Yeah, I knew he was called Frank. So Archie is actually lined up to be a great sprinter. And he can, this is that he gets into this theme constantly of running and being a great athlete. And he actually joins up and names himself after the Australia's greatest sprinter of like sort of the generation before called Lascelles. And so that's what the name that he uses, which people think is a bit weird when he's trying to join. And you see this scene at the start where he's running barefoot through the outback. The outback looks absolutely stunning in this as well. I mean, the cinematography is just fantastic throughout the whole thing. It's way. I remember, you know, in Master and Commander, where Peter Weir, the cinematography is just lovely because he lingers on like the ship with the sun going down in the background, and it just gives you time to kind of absorb it and soak it all in. It's similar here, but except it's the outback and the desert. And then they make their way through it, and you see all of these sort of white picket fence type things. You know, one of the things as well that I do think is interesting is that when I was watching it, because this is similar to it's Australia is actually similar landscape. It's very remote. It's vast. And you wonder why did America develop the sort of the, why do we have these violent Westerns and there's no version of that with Australia? There doesn't seem to be any cultural version of that either. Whereas when you think of like, because you have, it seems to be that it's similar stock ethnically, and they're both out in a fresh, vast country making their way. And yet in America, it seems to have had this, it's just synonymous with cowboys, with guns, with killing. And Australia doesn't seem to have any of that, like lawlessness. And Australia doesn't seem to have any
there
of that.
There is a bit more of bush rangers and stuff like that, you know, the likes of Ned Kelly and what have you. So there's a little bit of that, but it's much less than in the USA for sure.
Yeah, I can add that in Canada. I mean, it's a similar frontier, but it was much less chaotic. I will say that it is the American West. The chaos is a bit overstated. So it's not exactly like in these Hollywood movies where you'd walk into a saloon and you'd get shot for looking at a guy in the wrong way. So, I mean, the chaos of the Wild West in the United States is a bit overstated by Hollywood and by the image we have of it in our consciousness culturally. However, it was like that to an extent. In Canada, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who were at the time, I believe, called the Royal Canadian Northwest Police, who later became our federal police, it was a police force which was founded to police the new frontier. So as Canada settled the interior of the country, moved out west, they didn't want to have this lawless situation. So they had this police force riding on horseback with the iconic red jackets policing the new frontier. And I don't know if Australia had something of a similar kind of police force, but I imagine that they did. But I do know that there was kind of a culture of lawlessness, like the song Waltzing Matilda, for example. It is about kind of this drifter who is kind of a bit of a scoundrel and a criminal. But yeah, you don't have the same idea that we do with the American frontier, that's for sure.
Yeah, you get people like Ned Kelly, for example, but there were quite a lot of bush rangers certainly in the first half of the 19th century. But yeah, nowhere near as violent as it is portrayed in American Westerns.
I mean, Mel Gibson's introduced as being a bit of a lad, like, you know, he doesn't want to join the army. They're off doing some sort of real road work, and then they're hopping on the train and just leaving the job. So there is a sense of just kind of roaming around Australia. And I think that's nice because you just don't see it very often, because then you think, actually, yeah, we always see it this, like, with the Americans doing this, but it would have been, it's like there's an untold story about the taming of the Australian outback, which because Hollywood isn't in Australia, you're just not exposed to it that much. I used to love watching Bush Tucker Man on Channel 4 back in the day, because you got a bit of it then as well. Somebody in the chat as well says, just because it's like the sort of the beginning of the movie and that, and I thought I'd pick up on this. The intro scene whilst he is in the Outback is total woke bullshit, with the sticking it to the racist by cheating in an Outback desert during the bet scene. I think that's the Aborigine, where there's like a, I don't really think it's woke, but I don't know how that would play out, because that would have actually happened, where you would have had, because the relationship is like the Aborigine is almost like a sort of house slave. And then you've got this other sort of worker who doesn't like the fact how friendly he is. And I actually think you would have had that. You would have had these scenes where it's like, well, I'm not going to be mean to the fella because he's an Abu. I don't know how that would have played out in real life. Or was it that everybody just treats them like shit? Because the sort of the dynamic, especially when you bring in a kind of the English aristocratic angle to it, would have been a kind of noblesse oblige, a sort of take care of the underclass type thing. So I do take the point, though. I think it's because we've been we've had all of this kind of messaging rammed into us for so long, and it's so jarring, and you get so sick and tired of it, that when you look at an older film like this, It does kind of stick in your craw a bit. Like I do know what he means.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of felt that way with that scene. I kind of was annoyed by it, but it was just at the beginning of the movie, and then it doesn't come back. So I mean, it didn't spoil the film for me.
One of the things that before I miss this as well is that there's a when they're wandering through the desert, they come across an old fella with a camel, and he, when I was watching it, I recognized the voice straight away. And it was the fella who does the monologue in Mad Max 2, the opening monologue, the "my life fades," that whole thing about the end of the world and everything. That was the fella that they meet in the desert, where he's just wandering about with the camel. That's actually the fella who did that monologue. And I thought it's fascinating, because I've loved Mad Max 2 all my whole life. But I never imagined that. Like, yeah, I never thought, who is that bloke who does that monologue? And there you are. You have him in this film. And that's another thing about the Australian like new wave films of this era, is that you see the same faces pop up again and again. Like one of the people doing the recruiting for the army, he's in Mad Max 1 as well. I think he's the fella that Mad Max, like Mel Gibson, crushes under the car. And you'll see like people pop up from Prisoner Cell Block H and all that kind of thing. And I think it's nice. I think it's great when you watch these Australian films. It's as if they've got like 30 actors and they all pop up and like in everything, including Mel Gibson himself, though obviously he went on to do like much bigger and better things. But by my reckoning, this would have been kind of like in the same year that he did Mad Max 2, the year after, or a year after Mad Max or something like that.
One thing that I'll say that struck me in the first part of the film is that it takes place in Western Australia. Now, I think, I'm pretty sure, Duke, you live out in Western Australia, don't you?
No, mate, I live in Victoria, other side of the country.
Okay, sorry. Well, it's a pretty rural place. Now, I've never been to Australia, but I know that even to this day, I think only about 3 million people live in that entire territory, but it's like half the size of Europe. And there's really only just one big city, that's Perth. And most of the people live in that one city. Other than that, it's pretty much entirely empty. And you have to imagine back then what it would have been like. So I looked up the demographic history of Australia at the time. Now, I mean, other than the fact that Australia had the white Australia policy, it was an entirely white country other than the Abos. Around the time of the First World War, Western Australia would have had a population of much less than a million people. So Perth, the biggest, what they call a city, and they're even saying in the film, like, we have to get to Perth. We got to get to we got to catch the train to Perth. The recruitment office is there. It only had about 200,000 people in it. So you're looking at this massive territory with which is almost entirely empty. And it's because Australia, like we mentioned at the beginning, was kind of this untamed frontier at the time. And it was a very young nation. So I believe that Australia only became a dominion in the British Empire, so an independent country, in 1901. So that's less than 20 years earlier. And from the perspective of such a young nation, something like the First World War, especially to guys who were just living in these in rural Western Australia, where the biggest city is, it has less than 200,000 people. So an event like World War One would have just been absolutely monumental to them. So the idea of these massive superpowers like the British Empire, which they were part of, and Germany clashing in Europe and the old world way far off, it would have just been absolutely monumental for them, which is why, I mean, it's certainly the case for us in Canada, but I probably imagine it's the same in Australia. It's that this kind of played like such a big pivotal role in forming the national consciousness, because it was kind of the first time as a young nation that Australia was on the world stage, and especially in Gallipoli, that not only the loss of life, which we'll get on to later, but the important role that they actually played in that campaign. You really get the sense at the beginning of the movie, you know, when they're guys working on these farms or on these railroads out in the far reaches of Western Australia, that they're embarking on this massive, I guess, adventure. I don't want to say adventure because at the end of the film, it certainly isn't romanticized. But you have to just imagine that it might, that like a world war at the time to somebody living in this brand new country, which has just barely been settled, it would have just seemed like absolutely monumental. You really get the sense from the guys as they're sitting at the railroad that they mispronounce Gallipoli. They're saying, "Well, where is that?" They're reading about it in the newspaper, and it's kind of this, like, they use the phrase "baptism by fire" for the Australian forces there. And it's one of the events that really brought countries like Australia and Canada into their own.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the film, because obviously Archie's dad doesn't want him to go to the war. He thinks he's going to be this great athlete. He thinks he's sort of being daft. He thinks he's stupid for running around in these bets and these races and barefoot, because it's destroying his feet. But there's a scene where he reads sort of the last few pages of the Jungle Book. And what's interesting about that is that he's describing Mowgli becoming resigned to the fact that he has to now leave the jungle and return to the world of men, where he's toying over that idea. And I thought that plays well with when you look at how remote they are, because Archie isn't just on Australia, which is itself like totally remote, but even then he's way out in the outback with his family. On like a family farm, like a ranch. And so I do think that was an interesting, that was put in the movie for a reason. And it was as if to say, you've been kind of protected away from the horrors of the world and the harshness of life. You've been cosseted out here in the middle of nowhere. And like Mowgli, you're now going to go into the world of men and see what they're all about. And of course, spoiler, sorry everybody, but the final scene of the film is him being sort of riddled with machine gun bullets and just generally kind of descending into hell as the film goes on, which is another reason why this sort of meandering structure works, I think, is that you're not just, you know, like when you see something like Saving Private Ryan and it's just immediate gunfire, they just throw you into the action. That's it's not like that at all. You're already well acquainted and you know the characters. A lot of the time in war movies, like from a kind of storytelling perspective, this will be my sort of last defense of the kind of drawn out nature of this film. One of the things, if from to write a war story and to create narrative around it, is that you actually have to make the wider audience care about the main characters. So if they're just cannon fodder, if they're just kind of generic sort of characters, it doesn't matter that much because when they go into the battle. So you'll see on normal war movies, they'll give them a little backstory of how they want to get back, or that you know that they've got a wife They've got like a farm in Ohio, or they want to get back to the coal mines, or whatever it happens to be. So it sort of humanizes and fleshes out the character. What you get in Gallipoli is like almost the entire film is the backstory and the characters, and so then in the end they're thrown into hell, and I think that works well. But you've got to kind of get it, because we're used to just having the instant gunfire these days, and you really have to wait for a payoff, and it's not even much of a payoff. It's just bleak, really.
Well, I think that's what the war must have been like for most of the guys, especially the Anzacs that died at Gallipoli, because you would have, the war would have started. You would have been on your homestead out in Western Australia or wherever it was. You would have gone to a city like Perth, enlisted and gone off to training. And then for a lot of them, as soon as they land on the beach, they get gunned down and then that's it. So honestly, like, it actually is kind of an accurate portrayal of what the First World War must have been to a lot of the Anzacs.
I think it's worth mentioning that everyone in 1914, all over the world, everyone thought that World War One was going to be a big adventure. This was quite common. Of course, it was totally wrong, but that's what most people thought. It wasn't like confined to places like Australia. And the other thing that's worth pointing out is that a lot of the Anzacs were actually second or sometimes even first generation British settlers, because huge numbers of people, but like there's the myth that Australia was settled by convicts, but the vast majority of Australians are not actually descended from convicts at all. They're descended from free settlers, and 90% of those free settlers came from Britain and Ireland, basically.
They make a point here as well. They're singing a song, and it's basically when England calls, like, we obey, or something like that. So that they've got this, they genuinely think of Britain as being the mother country, and the mother country needs help. So we have a duty to go over and help with the battle. And then on the way, it turns out that Mel Gibson can't actually ride a horse, and that's how they get split up. And then the next port of call is in Egypt, which I think is probably the weakest section of the film, if I'm honest. And because you get up to this normal stuff where they're going through the training, and then there's like prostitutes in Egypt, and they get to it's kind of a bit bawdy humor, and the idea is that it's all the lads having a bit of a laugh and all of this kind of thing, and you see the pyramids in the background, but it's a bit of rough and tumble when they're playing rugby and all of that kind of thing. But when I was watching it, I was thinking, right, so I thought, well, this is it, they're going to leave, they're getting on the ship, and then it's like, oh no, we're actually going to be training in Egypt, and there's more running as well. There's another race.
That bit is actually accurate, because one of the problems for the Anzacs, which for anyone in the chat who doesn't know, is the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps. That's what Anzac stands for. One of the problems for them was that they actually hadn't had a lot of training. They weren't regular professional soldiers. They were volunteers. And so they needed that time in Egypt to get some training. And in fact, they didn't really get enough, to be quite honest. But
you also see that, what I mentioned earlier with Australia being this old nation, you do see the contrast between that and Egypt in the middle act of the movie, where they're training outside the pyramids. The pyramids are in the background. They're in the desert in Egypt. And it's like the contrast between Australia as a new nation and Egypt as this ancient civilization. And then it also just feels extremely foreign to them. So like they're in Cairo, and it's just filthy. And there are these dirty prostitutes. There are these scam artists. They're trying to scam these guys by tricking them into buying what they believe to be ancient Egyptian souvenirs when they're really just cheap junk. The other thing is, like, you have people have to remember is that back then, this is before mass travel. So of course the settlers in Australia did travel around the world, but most people wouldn't do much traveling aside from something like that, unless they were relocating to a colony. Most people didn't actually, they wouldn't have gone on vacation to places like Egypt. Maybe if you were a scholar like Lawrence of Arabia, you might have done something like that. But the average person probably would have lived their entire life within, you know, within, certainly within their country, but maybe even just within a certain portion of the country. Of course, there were railroads at the time, so you could, you know, you could travel around the railroad, but it just must have been like really foreign. And that seems to be the most adventurous part of it, of the movie, is when they're out in Egypt and when they're training underneath the pyramids. That's the part that actually kind of seems like an adventure. The war itself, when they actually get into battle, it doesn't feel like that at all. But you have to just imagine what that must have been like for a guy at the time to go around the world on this ship to this strange foreign country and you're partaking in world events. It would have been pretty incredible for a guy from a homestead in Western Australia.
Yeah, this is like you mentioned Lawrence of Arabia. These what we are following here are like the officers which are around Lawrence of Arabia at the start, where they're not these kind of grandiose, kind of narcissistic poet warriors. They're just normal lads. They're just normal lads being thrown into the thick of it. And they're naive as well. There's a certain naivety which comes with them about the way of the world. Another thing that I will say, like, because we mentioned about the Aborigine, the kind of the woke little encounter with the Aborigine. As is usual in these movies, the way Egypt is depicted and the Egyptians are depicted here would, by today's standards, be thought we'd be called racist. And the way the Turks are depicted definitely would. In these World War One movies, the Turks always come out like they always get like the ugliest actors you can get. The Turks get a real hammering. The Turks really get the shitty end of the stick in these World War One films. Like, they always look like these kind of lecherous, sort of greasy orcs. Now, somebody mentioned to me somewhere when I forgot what was I going to say, that the Turks in this movie were, well, it might have been something else. It might have been something else that I was watching, but that they were not actually Turkish. But I think I might be getting that mixed up with something else that I watched. But the Turks never come out of this very well at all, and neither do the Egyptians. To be honest, what surprised me was that it looks like a kind of grotty version of Amsterdam or something. Like, there's just prostitutes everywhere, and you just don't think of it like that. You know, they're all these like little hustling bazaars trying to rip you off and claw your eyeball. But even you think, oh well, it's Islamic, so they've got their women under control, but they didn't. There was rife with prostitutes according to this film, and I wasn't there.
Morgoth, I can tell you, I watched this movie with my dad, like probably when it came out, I think, or not long afterwards. And my dad served in Egypt in the British Army in the very early 1950s. And he said, yes, it's accurate. That's what Egypt was like when he was there in like 1951. He said it was exactly like that.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? So were they not as strictly Islamic back then? Like, because now
they weren't. No, they weren't as strictly, and also because there were so many soldiers there, there was money to be made. You know, you don't have to think too deeply about what the soldiers want. Well, obviously, they want beer bars and women, basically. I mean, you know, which is what they were provided with. So, you know.
And they get a. There's a scene where they're all getting told by the sergeant, is it, or the captain or whatever, that basically you will get a sexually transmitted disease, and it will be painful and it will be embarrassing, but I already know that you're going to do it anyway. And then they bring up like a blackboard with like the male reproductive organ, and they're standing there pointing at like the balls and stuff and saying like it's got all of these different things that you're going to catch all over it, and they just all burst out laughing. And I thought, that's kind of how it would have been, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, I've never been to Egypt, but from what I've heard, Cairo is like a pretty grotty and disgusting place today. So, I mean, you know, with Islam, to be honest, like all their places are crap. I mean, I know they have their like religious codes, but they usually end up kind of being like that.
I watched a video a while ago on YouTube, and it was like this lad popped up. I think he was Norwegian. I forgot the name of the channel, but he was doing great videos. And he made a video, and it was about these like gigantic third world countries like Cairo, and all these like just these huge sprawling like Calcutta. And he made the point, like, you know, they've got like these giant sprawling tens and tens of millions of people, and they have produced absolutely nothing of any worth. And he was basically saying, like, the way that I think the channel might be gone now, I think, because he was getting close to the bone for YouTube, like, so I'm going to have to watch what I say as well. But the way that he framed it was just like this sort of biomass, like a virus or anything. And they've given, and it does make you wonder where some of these third world players, like these, well, they're not even third world, now they're like, what other? When, like, Cairo. And you think, yeah, what actually, all of these people there, what are they, what great art is being produced? What scientific innovations are, what are they doing with themselves all of this time? And you see, like in his video, he had this like kind of pathetically inept sort of infrastructure where there was wire cables just dangling around and nobody could be bothered to clean anything up. Nothing was maintained. The roads didn't work properly because nobody cared about rules or regulations or anything like that. And like, I remember when I was growing up as well, I know I'm going on a bit of a ramble here, but when I was growing up as well, like I got, for some reason I got in school, I got like this endless, I think I might have had a libtard geography teacher, and he just prattled on and on and on for weeks about Sao Paulo and about like this great, wonderful Brazilian city called Sao Paulo that had fallen into rack and ruin. And it just looked like a total shithole. Like, I couldn't imagine anywhere more miserable to live. It's the same, like the Cairo is like a meme where it's just this unending mass of like ugly construction buildings where people do nothing all day but like kind of grift and hustle and eat and breed and drink whatever sort of waters they can filtrate out of the Nile or whatever. And you just think, Most people like live that today. I mean, to be fair, in Gallipoli, at least it's sort of contained a bit. At least it looks old fashioned. But they kind of seem to do this half and half where they get certain aspects of modernity, like electricity and block concrete, but they don't actually build upon it. They don't actually improve anything. It's so you've just got this sort of stagnant mass of people that contribute nothing. I mean, I'm heading into sort of getting a YouTube channel that's taken down at this point, but it is a thing. Like it is a thing, because look, you can point all kinds of great things that were coming out of just Australia at this time, or just Scotland, or just a certain area of Germany. And today you can point to like one of these cities in Bangladesh or somewhere, which has got like 15 million people. And they just do nothing. Nothing of worth is created.
Yeah. I mean, you can look at Australia. Yeah. Look at Australia today versus, I mean, it's a country with whose history is only around 200 years, whereas Egypt, it's thousands of years. And, you know, the Arabs have had Egypt for the last 1500 years, and well, who's produced more quality?
I mean, yeah, somebody in the chat says the repugnant conclusion philosophy. And I don't know, I've never heard of that before, but I kind of think that's where I am. Like, you end up in a place where you end up thinking, well, maybe the world does need to be depopulated. Like, maybe it would be better just to have far, far fewer people on the world, but better people. Because you end up having this kind of gag reflex when you see humanity as it, like, as most of humanity actually is. It's just not particularly very nice. But let's, with that said, and if I don't get immediately taken off YouTube, like, the you move on though to contrast that, because there's a bit of a jar. Let's move on to Gallipoli itself. Because it does relate to this, you could argue. So I've set up one argument. Let's do the other one. The opposite, like, what you can get from thinking too much like that is a kind of arrogance. So that when you come up against these people in war, when, I mean, yeah, let's get a little bit topical for a second. When you have a large Islamic country, which is actually a little bit more advanced than what you thought, because you've been a little bit arrogant, and when they've got a strait or a choke point on the sea, which is heavily defended, and they can shoot down at your ships and your men, maybe your arrogance can get you into some sticky situations. Because this is basically the whole point, what we've been leading to with Gallipoli, is that it was an absolute unmitigated disaster, and that's what they were always heading to in the film anyway.
I mean, one thing that's also important to note is that the Turks, who the British Empire and the Allies fought at Gallipoli, were a lot higher quality than the ones that they had fought earlier in the war. So I think that I don't know if I have the history exactly correct, but I think that the earlier campaigns against the Ottoman Empire in places like near the Suez Canal and such, I believe that they were fighting Arabs under the rule of the Turks, whereas in Gallipoli, they were actually fighting Turks, the rulers of the Ottoman Empire, on their own home turf. So it was a step up from, you know, the kind of things you'd see in Egypt, which I know Egypt was technically part of the British Empire at the time. But that kind of like border around Sinai, and like this would have been the at least as I understand it, the best of the Turkish army. And Ataturk himself, Mustafa Kemal, was actually a general at Gallipoli. So they were up against a lot higher quality of troops than they had faced earlier.
Yeah, there was even a German general there. Well, let's like sort of take a detour and have a look at Gallipoli itself, because and like what went on there. Do you want to take it, Duke?
Yeah, look, it didn't help that the Royal Navy and the French Navy warned the Turks what we were going to do, because they did a bombardment of the Turkish forts on both sides of the strait here that you can see. That one with the red flash on it is actually the Gallipoli Peninsula. But there were also Turkish forts on the other side. And the Royal Navy did a bombardment, which was quite successful, but they had no troops. So they couldn't really take advantage of it. And what that did was it warned the Turks what was going on. And just to let people understand the strategic idea behind this, which I think is bullshit anyway, but it was Churchill's idea, of course. And anyone who knows me knows I'm no great fan of Winston Churchill. His idea was that if we captured the Gallipoli Peninsula, we could then send the Royal Navy up to Constantinople. The Turks would surrender, which they may or may not have done. And then the main reason for it was that via the Black Sea, we could then supply the Russians, who, of course, were fighting against the Germans, as well as the Austro-Hungarians. It was nonsense, of course, because Russia wasn't doing very well in the First World War. It's partly why they had the revolution in 1917. But yeah, we warned them in advance. And I think it's worth pointing something else out that most people certainly don't realize. Far, far more British troops were killed at Gallipoli than Anzacs. Far more. Like four times as many. because we had more troops there. On the day of the Gallipoli landings, when the Anzacs landed, the British 29th Division also landed, which was the last regular division in the British Army, which had been collected from garrisons all around the empire. And they also suffered appalling casualties because the Turks were waiting for them, basically. And the hills and what have you on the Gallipoli Peninsula are very steep. It's very, very rugged terrain. So there was no space to deploy the troops properly. There was no safe areas behind them where you could put supplies and field hospitals and all the stuff that you need in a war. So it went very badly. And then later on, they sent out more British troops from the Kitchener's New Army. And those guys also got badly slaughtered, basically. And after that, they decided, oh, this is no good. And they withdrew all the troops. Very successfully, actually. The withdrawal was the only bit that went smoothly, really. And of course, Churchill lost his job for a while. But it was always a harebrained scheme. And on this side, by the way, the lower side of the map here, the French landed soldiers in that part. And this part was the Brits and Australians.
In the film, they say it where basically they are the Australians and the New Zealanders, they are like a distraction or a feint to draw enemy fire towards them because the Brits are going to sort of make a major landing elsewhere and then they will have free passage. And I think I've picked up before that, is it the case that they were sort of shafted? Because you don't seem to think that, because you were saying where the Brits got the heaviest casualties of all. Was there a thing where they are saying we've been fed into the meat grinder, so the British army doesn't?
I don't think so, Morgoth. As I say, about four times as many British troops were killed in Gallipoli as the Australians. I think everyone was shafted, including the British troops.
Yeah, Endeavour?
I don't know. I'm not a military historian, but I do know that I'm pretty sure the point of the Australian attack was to cut off the peninsula. So you see at the top of the screen there, they were meant to land higher up the peninsula so that they could cut off the Turks from sending reinforcements to the place where the main attack was coming down low. I mean, I can't say one way or the other whether they were shafted, but I don't get the sense that they were. I get the sense that the entire Gallipoli campaign was just a disaster and it was a bloodbath for everyone involved on the Entente side.
Yeah, and it's kind of typical of World War One, because it basically this was the same story across all fronts in World War One, was just this slaughterhouse everywhere. And even on these, so you know, we've done a few movies on World War One, but it would have been in Belgium, the Somme, or all of that. But here you see that it's kind of the similar dynamic plays out, where it's just this sort of frivolous way of frittering away the lives of these young men. And this is exactly what Gallipoli is about. And it's when you get there, I mean, there is actually a few more other characters, like side characters, and they're all, you know, cheeky lads. But when they first arrive, like, it's not much seems to happen. And I think this is what people, like, what people today, when we look at World War One, you look at the trench warfare, it's seen as being this sort of mechanized slaughter. But if you were actually there, it would be just sitting around not doing much for a lot of the time, like waiting to go over the top. And it was like, what do you do in all those hours? So in Gallipoli, they do that well, because it isn't just the case, you know, it isn't Saving Private Ryan where you jump off and there's just gunfire straight away. They're sitting around bored and they're wandering around and they'll see the odd cross. And at one point they see like a hand sticking out of the trench, but they're kind of like still full of jokes. They're still full of, you know, laughter. But then it dawns on them, because it isn't that it kind of goes from like 1 to 10, and what happens is they end up going over the top, and then the Turks are just mowing them down by the thousands. And none of them expected it. None of them really understood what the hell was going on. And we've got to remember what was set up earlier in the film was that both Frank and Archie are very fast, very great runners. So Mel Gibson's character becomes a runner. I think Hitler, well, that's what Hitler did as well in the war, wasn't it?
It's also important.
Yes, it was.
It's important to note that Archie was actually selected for the task, but then since he realized that, well, he was the one that dragged Frank to the war, so he's the one that brought Mel Gibson to the war, his character, he wanted him to do it so that he wouldn't have to be the one who went over the top. So Archie was actually originally meant to be the runner, but then he said to the officer, make Frank do it. I'm the reason that he's here, so let Frank be the runner. He's as fast as me.
Yeah.
And so he was giving him a chance of surviving.
Yeah. And so the question's raised, like, is this correct? Has there been, like, if this many men are dying this quickly, like, this cannot be just the plan. Like, this there's something not right here. And so that you get this kind of back and forth where Mel Gibson, obviously, again, can run very fast. And he's going backwards and forwards, delivering messages to the higher command, and then back to his superiors in the trenches. And then you get in, well, it's on a clock. So now they're going to go over the top unless he can get to, what is it, the general, and then back with the message, which would say, we don't like the way this is going. And that actually does happen. It's like, well, look, okay, tell the men to stay put until we have a look at what's going on. So then he's got like sort of 20 minutes to get back, and he doesn't make it. And the whistle goes, and they all go over the top, and they all get mown down. It's quite heart wrenching, to be honest. It's especially because we've followed their story all the way from the outback to this stage, and it reminds us again like of this sort of where he's using the Jungle Book. It is as if to say a Mowgli contemplating coming out of the jungle, and here you are, like here you are in the real world, in the blood and guts of it. You're no longer in the outback where you're safe and protected. Here in this place, your life means absolutely nothing. It means nothing that you are potentially the next sprinting champion of Australia. You're just a statistic like everybody else. It really hammers home this idea that, and it's because we followed their stories for so long, we knew all of the details of their lives, and then it's just snuffed out, just like that. It's quite harrowing, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, it is a pretty intense scene and a very sombering one. One scene that really got me was where the officer in the trench, he has seen two charges go over the top, and both of them just get immediately mown down. But he's given orders that he has to attack. But what he's saying is, like, there's just no way. But then, you know, his superior officer who's not at the front lines is giving them the order, and he realizes, like, he's going to have to do it. And then he says that, well, I can't make the men do something I wouldn't do myself. So he gets up and he says, remember that you're men from Western Australia. And then they charge. And then, of course, they get shot down. And then Archie gets in the very last scene of the film, the very last shot. It's just Archie being mown down by machine gun fire. I guess, like, what you have to wonder is, how do you actually approach something like this and the memory of it? Because it's not glorious at all. Like, just running over a trench and getting shot down immediately. It doesn't feel glorious. It doesn't feel like an adventure. It just feels like death. However, there's also something to admire about men who have the courage to run into certain death and to do that with their own homelands on their mind. I mean, it certainly wasn't glorious charging over the top and being shot down by machine gun fire. But, you know, that scene where he says to them, you know, remember that you're men from Western Australia. and that, you know, that's what's on their mind. Their, you know, little homestead back and back thousands of miles away. Yeah, I mean, that is pretty poignant. I do think that this is why the Battle of Gallipoli and the Gallipoli campaign had such an impact on the Australian psyche.
Yeah, it's kind of like a coming of age sort of, you know, now you are like with the rest, now you belong with the old nations. Now you've had your 10,000 dead in one campaign type thing. It's all like the end of innocence is now here. I totally understand why that would be on their minds, why it would have impacted them like that, where it's almost like they've been deflowered or something.
You've got to remember the a combination of trenches, barbed wire, lots of artillery, machine guns and magazine rifles, and you know, the human body is a pretty weak thing to try and overcome all that. And you couldn't in certain situations. And that certainly did happen at Gallipoli. I think it's also worth remembering that a lot more Australians died on the Western Front, because after Gallipoli, the Australians were shipped to France. And a lot more of them died there than died at Gallipoli.
I think that one of the reasons that Gallipoli... Now, I'm saying this from an outsider perspective, but I think I can kind of relate as a Canadian. I think one of the reasons that Gallipoli might have just played such a big role in the Australian national psyche is that a country like England, so like Duke mentioned that there were a lot more British soldiers who died at Gallipoli than Australians, but Britain was a country which had thousands of years of history before that. They, you know, had the Hundred Years' War. They had all the wars between the Napoleonic Wars, and they would have had the Crimean War, and just like going back. And I'm not trying to diminish the importance of any of that, but for a country like Australia, nothing like that ever would have happened in their history before that. So
I actually did a post on X the other day on Anzac Day, mm-hmm. the first large number of Australians to go overseas for a war was in 1885, when the New South Wales contingent went to the Sudan. At the same time as the Gordon Relief Expedition, they fought around the Red Sea port of Suakin, and almost nobody remembers them today. And the Australians also took part in the Boxer Rebellion, and obviously lots of them fought in the Boer War as well.
Right. It's like that with Canada too. So we also Canadian troops also fought in the Boer War. So I'm not saying that Australians had never, you know, participated in a war abroad before that, and you know, it's important to remember, like Duke mentioned, that you shouldn't forget about the Anzacs who fought in Sudan and in the Boer War and in the Boxer Rebellion. However, it just must have never been anything on that scale before. And Canada also kind of, the First World War also kind of plays the same role for Canada. So one story which I've always found very poignant is the Newfoundlanders at the Battle of the Somme. So the Royal Newfoundland Regiment suffered 90% casualties in a single day in the Battle of the Somme. So a huge, I mean, and so there were hundreds of them who died. And just remember that the population of Newfoundland at the time, which Newfoundland was an independent dominion at the time. So it was its own country, and later it joined Canada after the Second World War. But that's a huge percentage of the male population of Newfoundland who died in a single day. So there were hundreds of them who died in a single day. And in a country with only about 200,000 people, that's pretty significant. I think I remember hearing that was the worst casualty rate of any regiment during the First World War was the Newfoundlanders. A similar story for me is the Canadians at Hong Kong during the Second World War. So in our national consciousness, it's always Vimy Ridge in the First World War and Juno Beach in the Second World War, which were our two greatest successes. So the successful assault at Vimy Ridge, and then of course D-Day. Those are the two that are the most famous. But I've always the Battle of Hong Kong has always really resonated with me because of how horrific it really was for the Canadian troops there. So what happened was, At the end of 1941, just as the Japanese were about to attack Hong Kong, about 2,000 Canadian soldiers from Winnipeg arrived in Hong Kong just days before the colony was about to fall. I think that I think they arrived in November, and then it was attacked in early December, and then it fell on Christmas of 1941. And there were about 2,000 of them. I think over 200 died in the battle, and then another 200 or so, 250 or so died in captivity. So a quarter of the Canadians who shipped off to Hong Kong in the Second World War, they never came back. And of course, you know, every nation likes to remember their successes. And of course, you know, we do. We can remember the Battle of Waterloo for the British, or, you know, for Canada, I mentioned Vimy Ridge or Juneau Beach. But there is also something to be said about these, the valiant effort which went towards a lost cause, something like the Gallipoli campaign. The Charge of the Light Brigade is another kind of similar story from British history that plays a similar role. That I think that this is kind of, it's this kind of like poignant lost cause that these men gave their lives and then, you know, unfortunately were mown down, but just kind of the trauma, but also the admiration you have for the courage. I think that there's something very powerful to that. And I mean, I'm not Australian, so I can't speak for them, but I kind of see that's the kind of sense that I get from their celebration of Anzac Day.
Somebody in the chat says England has anti-white Semitic rulers. They should never have attacked Turkey. The thing is, it isn't just like the Royal Navy rocked up on the shores of Turkey and started bombing them for nothing. Turkey were on the other side in a world war. And the idea was to relieve the Russian section of the war so that they could concentrate more forces in Europe against the Germans. And obviously you can get into the reasons of the war itself and all of the World War One in particular is pretty complicated and hellish, to be honest. But the thing is, this is why I tend to be so anti-war. And it's once the war's begun, and look, let's be honest, we're dancing around it a little bit, but you can kind of see it in the Persian Gulf. Is that it's that thing, that meme, that Mike Tyson thing, everybody has a plan until you get punched in the face, is so accurate, because once things sort of unfold, your original plan just goes out the window and you've kind of got to make things up on the fly as you go along. And as you do that, things get more and more complicated and more things go wrong. So I do think this campaign was ridiculous. Given that at this point, the British Navy had hundreds of years of experience, the idea that you would go through like a thin strait, just expose it. I'm not an expert on this stuff, but it does speak to a degree of hubris. And I don't know, like, and it's another one of those things where Churchill would be back again. So he actually, he was sacked, and then he agreed to sign up to go to the front lines. But as is so often the case, that didn't happen. So he didn't actually die in a trench somewhere. But not only that, but then he kind of lingers around the British establishment for decades to come and becomes this kind of legendary figure that we see today. But you just think if you are responsible for a disaster of this scale, all right. So he agreed that he would sign up, but then how is that not just tarnish you forever? And it's this thing that I despise about the British establishment, and it's that the actual British people can be, you know, today you'll think of it like the grooming gang scandals, or you think of the casual crime inflicted because of the immigration. Back here, it was the casually frittering away the lives of thousands upon thousands of men on harebrained schemes. And then like not facing sort of a noose for it, but not even being banished out of the establishment, being welcomed back in a few years later. You know, it amazes me that, say, Boris Johnson did the Boris wave, but according to like the London establishment and the British media, his greatest crime was having a party during the lockdowns. Like that's what did him in. And they'll commit these colossal treasonous crimes. The incompetence will be staggering. The indifference to suffering and misery, unbelievable. But that's not what gets them. What gets them is always some kind of technicality, and it infuriates us. But then, you know, so once the war is actually up and running and you see, well, we'll have to actually relieve the stress on the Russians so that they can funnel in their steamroller into the, and, you know, take them away from the Turks and throw them at the Germans and all the rest of it. There is a kind of bloody sort of logic to it once you're actually in it and you've got to pull these rabbits out of a hat. And this is why you just look at what's happening. Just look at the mess we're in today with the Americans. And it's why I tend to be a total dove when it comes to war. Because when you look at the capital as well, like if you put this in today's terms, where you've got all of these lives, the best human capital in the world. And then, at least in them days, you had a healthy birth rate. We don't even have that now. So once they're gone, they're gone. And this is why I'm just always, always opposed to wars, which can spiral out of control. And before you know it, you're done. You're done and dusted as a civilization at this rate, because we've already got deathbed demographics. It was bad enough 100 odd years ago when this was happening in the first war, and then again in the second war. So, you know, it's just so we're in such a precarious position. We do not have the luxury of throwing young European lads like that into these meat grinders, particularly when it's as stupid as going into a choke point where you're surrounded on all sides.
I mean, one thing that's also...
And the enemy are higher than you is also worth pointing out, Morgoth. The Turks held all the high ground, so they had better observation. And as I said, because the peninsula is so narrow, there was no safe reserve area. So the troops were constantly under artillery fire, even if they weren't under small arms fire. It was a complete fuck up, basically.
Yeah, one thing that the movie kind of does allude to this. So Archie's character, he is a bit more, he is like a bit more of a prestigious guy. He's upper middle class. His family is like not super wealthy, but they have a bit of money. He's going to be this champion athlete. He's going to be the best runner in Australia. One thing that, you know, sometimes you'll hear this from leftists sometimes, that they'll say like that World War One, like Marxists and stuff, they'll say it was like the capitalist class or something, or the typical stuff you hear from them. One thing, and it's incorrect, because one thing that people sometimes forget is that if you look at a country like Britain, the death rate among people in the aristocracy, young men who were from the upper class, was staggering. So like a huge number of the best of British society, of upper class, you know, extremely competent young men actually lost their lives. Now, I mean, some people have had this like theory that the reason that we are the way we are today is because the best of our genetic stock was killed in the world wars. I don't know if I don't subscribe to that theory, but it is true to remember that, you know, it was people across society, working class, middle class, even upper class, whose lives were really just kind of thrown away, which is why the First World War. I mean, I think the problem with the Second World War is it's too polluted with the propaganda of the post-war narrative, because I honestly think we should view it in the same way as we view the First World War. Now, we can admire the heroism, we can admire the courage, we can admire the spirit of men who went over the top into a certain death, but you have to remember that it was just a bloodbath, and it's like the kind of loss of life, there's really just nothing glorious about it. Honestly, I think this is how we should remember the Second World War as well. But we do unfortunately don't get we get the kind of propagandized narrative. But since World War One is not as political, it hasn't been as politicized as the Second World War has under the current zeitgeist. You get artworks of art like Gallipoli, like All Quiet on the Western Front, which really deal with the very human aspect of the First World War, which was just mass death.
Yeah. Any parting shots, Duke?
I largely agree with what you two chaps have said. I think it's worth pointing out that in World War One, the Australians, for example, were always all volunteers, but the British Army only brought conscription in World War One in 1917. So that many of the guys who were killed from countries like Britain, Canada, Australia, etc., they were the best people in the country from all classes because they volunteered. You know, they were the guys who thought, yeah, I'll go and help my country. And what they got for it was to get killed, basically.
Oh, there is one other topic I did want to bring up. I mean, the first thing I'll just say, I did prepare this part about the Australian nation and how I feel about them. But then I wanted to also talk about kind of how we commemorate our holidays and what's going on with them today. So I've never been to Australia in my life. I've only met a handful of Australians. So I don't really know much about the country, but I do feel a significant degree of brotherhood and solidarity with them as a Canadian, because we're both settler nations whose ancestry is derived from the British Isles. Of course, we have the French contingent in Canada as well, but we were both part of the British Empire. And despite Canada and Australia being on the opposite sides of the world and having totally different geographic land masses, our common biosphere derived from the British Isles result in our two nations developing extremely similarly. Canadians and Australians, I think we're both Canada and Australia, we conquered these very inhospitable frontiers and crafted these world-class countries out of it, which until very recently were the envy of the world. And as a result of this kind of frontiersmanship spirit, Canadians and Australians were very hard-nosed people, very adventurous, very innovative. And I do really deeply admire the Australian nation, and something like Gallipoli and Anzac Day, it resonates with me because it's also reflective of how the First World War plays into the Canadian national consciousness. The histories of our country are very similar. And unfortunately, that goes up to the predicament we're in today. So, you know, today it's pretty much the same deal, that we're ruled by this very similar, both Canada and Australia are ruled by this very similar, viciously anti-white globalist managerial class who want to dissolve our nations and turn them into this vapid mixed race economic zone, which belongs to no one in particular. And it's the same anti-white narratives of stolen land and how you have no special claim to your country. It's a so-called nation of immigrants, and that you should feel nothing but guilt and just open the floodgates and let your country be taken over, or else you're a racist. So, I mean, I view the country with having a lot of parallels with Canada. In many ways, I view them as a brother nation, even though, unfortunately, I don't know as much about them as I would like to.
We're copying Endeavour a lot of the nonsense that has gone on in Canada. So in Australia, you'll hear talk about First Nations and all this bullshit. You know, the First Nations who didn't invent anything more complicated than a dugout canoe or a bark hut. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and one thing, you mentioned this at the beginning of the stream, Duke, but I actually saw this going around on social media as well. So one thing, last year I made a video explaining why Western nations no longer have heroes. And what I argued was that it's this universalist egalitarianism, which has been imposed in the post-war era, that it makes it impossible for us to revere our own heroes, the men of our own genetic stock who fought for our nations. Instead, we're supposed to admire this vague, uninspiring mass of global humanity, that very humanity that Morgoth was talking about earlier when we talked about places like Cairo, where it's just this disgusting biomass, and it's not inspiring at all. And you see this effort to multiracialize things like Anzac Day or Remembrance Day. And what that does is it really robs it of the particularism of the holiday and what it really means to us as a people. So I saw this going around about Anzac Day, and it was like this in Canada as well. It was trying to like put Sikhs everywhere because, you know, like they're these ethno-narcissists who just want to make everything about themselves. And they just insist that like, oh, well, we actually, all of your heroism, well, we actually did that. And well, you need to feel guilty. And it's just this disgusting like insult to, it's just a disgusting insult to our ancestors and everything that something like Remembrance Day or Anzac Day was made for. Just, you have to remember that. At the time, Australia, up until the 1970, had the White Australia policy. Canada had this had a very similar immigration policy. It was European only, and not even just from Europe, but in particular, most of the immigrants to Canada and Australia came from the British Isles. So we were all cut from the same cloth, and there and that was the understanding that men who fought at Gallipoli or on the Western Front had. And I think it's important for us to remember that and to not let them kind of steal some from us, you know, what really should be important to our national consciousness.
Yeah, I've always had an affinity with Australians, New Zealanders, and Canadians. I see them as just as being like a wider family of the British Isles. Not particularly just British, because the Scots and Northern Irish, Welsh were in there as well. But basically, I've always seen them as just being an extension of like Britain. So something like Anzac Day is obviously just sort of reaffirming those bonds. And so when you universalize it, you're just dissolving those bonds of what the point was in the first place. And it's pretty depressing, to be honest. And there's a reason why, like, you can easily, I mean, when I was growing up, Australia was just seen as like paradise on earth. It was, so was Canada in a slightly different way, in a bit more of a kind of snowy north way. But they were even sort of thought of as places to escape to, as they would have been for, well, the two fellas on the screen there, their great grandparents or whatever. They did exactly that. And it was like the world is our oyster, and this is what that commemorates. And so when you have people who are outside of that sort of ethnic family, it's not about you, actually. It's about us. There is an us, and there is a you, there is a them, and this is about us and not you. So like, can we not have anything for ourselves anymore? They just go away. Like it's not about you. And you see it in this. In there's a scene when you've got these like aristocratic British officers with their monocles in, and then the Australians, the lads here are kind of taking the piss, and they get a couple of little mules, and they're like sort of impersonating them for being so stuck up and so pretentious. And then the English officers like say those Australians are, you know, that they're uncouth, they're rough around the edges, and they've got no manners whatsoever. But that's within a context that they are at the end of the day an extended family. So if they were to describe the Egyptians, they would use different terms. They would not view them. It's kind of like they are our cousins, and they're a bit of an embarrassment, and they're a bit rough around the edges. But they wouldn't have that. They wouldn't describe either the Turks or Russians or Egyptians in that way at all. It would be something completely different, because there isn't that kind of bond there. That's fine. It's great when there's a little bit of sort of inter-family piss-taking and ribaldry. But for some reason, it worked out different with the Americans. Obviously, they've been independent for a lot longer, but they do genuinely seem to have gone down a different path from that. There was much more of the white Commonwealth countries huddling around the motherland in ways the Americans didn't. And today, a lot of them seem to have nothing but contempt. But, you know, that's a whole different discussion, which is ongoing as we speak. So
There's one other thing I wanted to bring up, which it's not a huge thing, but there was this other story out of Australia that recently Ben Robert Smith, who is Australia's most decorated soldier from the Afghanistan war. So who was considered to be their greatest living war hero. He's now been arrested for murder on so-called war crimes. So because
he was set up in Dover. Apparently one of the other soldiers in his unit, and he was an SAS regiment soldier, so he was a special forces guy, and apparently what I hear is that one of the other soldiers in his unit is the bloke who dobbed him in, which to me is like, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, war is not neat and tidy, and sometimes the wrong people get shot. But why would you report that to anyone? I certainly wouldn't have done. Never. Wouldn't have thought about it.
What I find, though, is like that it goes back to my point of why we don't have heroes anymore, because like this feminized managerial universalism has made it illegal. So now that we're at the point today where Ben Robert Smith, Australia's greatest living soldier, who is considered their greatest war hero of the current century, it's not a commentary on the Afghanistan war, but the guy obviously was good at soldiering. And not that I want to romanticize war, but now he's being arrested. So they've made it illegal. There's another story from
Do you notice, Endeavor, that who never gets arrested, right? Never gets arrested. Is the politicians who send the soldiers to these fucking wars in the first place.
Right.
So,
yeah.
No one's going to arrest them. Like that scumbag Tony Blair in Britain, for example, who got 700 British soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan for absolutely jack shit. Nothing whatsoever.
Right. Yeah.
He won't get arrested. Oh, no. They'll make him Lord somebody or other. But yeah.
But then the guy who actually does go and do the dirty work, well, then he's going to be arrested. There's a story from World War One as well. I guess I wanted to bring it up because I don't know when else I'll have the chance to. But I don't know if you guys have ever heard of John Barney Hines. He was actually considered to be Australia's greatest and possibly even the greatest soldier in the First World War. So he was born in Britain. But he moved to Australia in, I think it was in the early 20th century. So I think he was from Liverpool. But he moved to Australia. He was a bit older, and he was pretty much he was a convicted criminal. He had a criminal record in New Zealand. He was a homeless guy. He was a drunk. He was vulgar. His officers hated him because he was insubordinate and he was disciplined many times. But on the battlefield, he was an absolute monster. So there's even a story of he fought on the Western Front. He didn't fight on the at Gallipoli, I don't believe. I think he was actually fighting on the Western Front. And He single-handedly captured, I think it was up to like 60 German soldiers. He lobbed grenades into these machine gun nests, and he took out a bunch of enemy soldiers, and he collected all of these trinkets. So there's a famous picture of him wearing a German hat and with all this like German memorabilia from the soldiers who he had captured during the war. I mean, I don't think the story is actually true, but there was this propaganda story at the time that the Kaiser saw this picture of John Barney Hines and was infuriated by it. And I've really just always loved the guy's story. And what's interesting about him is that by the time the Second World War came along, he was already in his 60s, and he was a homeless guy, I think living outside of Sydney. But he tried to sign up for the Second World War, even though he was this fat homeless bum at the time. But they turned him away. But you know, I mean, like, would he be considered a war criminal today? Would he be charged with war crimes? I mean, there's a reason, you know, we just don't have these great heroes anymore. Not to romanticize war, but it's because of this kind of like feminized gay managerialism mixed with this universalism that you never really get these figures who can play this important role in your national consciousness anymore, just because of the way that the zeitgeist has really just crippled our countries.
I thought if you're in any sort of war and you're attacking an enemy position, if the enemy don't surrender quickly enough, if they carry on shooting and killing and wounding your men until you get up to their position, those guys don't tend to survive. You know, and that's always been the case. I mean, people don't talk about it, but it's true. You know, if you wait too long to surrender, they don't let you surrender. They bloody well kill you, and perfectly understandable.
Yeah, you just know that. Now, I've never been in the military, but you just know that all of these like modern day quote unquote laws, they're all crafted by some short haired woman in The Hague and the Netherlands who would never even. Would never be in a situation like that. So it's just depressing how crippling kind of this like man as liberal universalist managerialism really is. I mean, it's why we can't have these national myths anymore, but also why you don't get that kind of masculine heroism anymore either.
I mean, just to go back on to touch on what I was saying before and what you're saying there, Endeavor, as well, is that when you look at the logic of the system that we live in, if you like, because we're talking about it being a wider family, I find the idea because say Australia is a separate country. So if you go by the magic soil theory, then what you're really talking about is that everybody was on that soil. I've never been to Australia. But I've obviously got more, say, ethnic affinity, compassion or empathy with, say, Nicole Kidman or Russell Crowe than I do with Kemi Badenoch or some fella from Pakistan or Nigeria or whatever. Yet this isn't supposed to be the case. But it obviously just is a fact. In reality, it is just the case. What, regardless of whatever rules and regulations and civic nationalist sort of talking points they come up with, it is the case that I've got more affinity with somebody of my stock who lives in New Zealand or Canada, Australia, than I do with an immigrant who's just come into the country. And that's just the way. And the immigrant, and it goes the other way as well. The people who are coming in don't have any affinity with me in the way that they will with their own. And it's just ridiculous to pretend it's otherwise. But yeah, okay. Well, there's a couple of super chats which I'm going to hit right now, unless anybody's got anything else to see. And they're both from Woolly Mammoth. Not sure if you gents know, but there is a new Steam FPS game named Gallipoli to be released in May, made by World War One Games, who an excellent Dutch studio. Yeah, I don't know anything about that. I don't really. What's that?
Oh, well, I mean, I haven't played that game, but I have played Verdun, which was a decent first person shooter back in the day. I think they made one that was in the Western Front. They made one called Tannenberg, which was the Eastern Front, and I think now they're making Gallipoli for the Middle Eastern campaign. Kind of cool. I mean, I liked the game. Good first person shooter, but not much to say beyond that.
All right, I don't know about these games. So thanks for the super chat anyway. Will you lads ever do James Cameron's Avatar 2009, aka the Hollywood film that invented the term trans-speciesism, humans turning into blue aliens? I don't know. I don't know if I'd have much to say about Avatar, because I get where you're going though with the thing, but with the question. But Avatar is itself just a rip-off of Dances with Wolves. And I would prefer to do a stream about Dances with Wolves. You know, one of the first ever articles that I wrote going way back, I mean, this will be like 2014 or something, what was a review of Dances with Wolves and all of the anti-white sort of messages and themes in it. And I asked the question, like, if it's okay for the Indians to worry, there's a scene in it where the Indians, like, asks Kevin Costner, how many more will come, meaning Europeans? And Kevin Costner says, like the stars. In other words, it's unending. Your way of life, your civilization, your people are heading for the dustbin of history. And there was this like sort of hypocrisy where I thought, why is it that I understand that I absolutely empathize with the Indian in that case, but why is it wrong then if somebody in a European country, or for that matter, Australia, which has been his theme here, has that sentiment. It's like borderline criminal. It fascinates me. And Dance says, and Avatar is kind of that again. It is that thing again. But yeah, you with a bit of kind of transhumanism thrown into the mix.
What I will say about, I haven't watched Dances with Wolves, and I'm not even really interested in it. I don't like Avatar either, and the reason is, of all the anti-white tropes I absolutely despise, it's the one that glorifies treason. The one that a white person, or even, you know, a human in the case of Avatar, but it's meant to be, you know, the white male, the guy of the West, betrays the West and sides with the out group against his own. I absolutely despise that, because that is the meta narrative. That's what's taught in Canada and in Australia. That's what makes you a quote unquote good person. And it's just been so debilitating to us. And that's just the one thing that gets under my skin more than any, is just this the glorification of the traitor. So I absolutely despise movies like that.
Yeah, in Kevin Costner finds redemption in siding with a different people against his own. That's the message that's being, it's pure boomer slop, as they say these days. That's, you know, back in the day, I would have found a different word for that, but like the internet turns everybody stupid, so everybody just resorts to slop. And back in the day, I would have had a different crap, maybe I would have said, but that's the message. And then there's another one with Tom Cruise where he does it, where he goes to the last samurai.
Yeah,
the last samurai. And I remember reading an article at Countercurrents years ago as well. And it really sort of shook me when I realized the way it was put, because in the case of the last samurai, you actually have a little bit, it goes a little bit further than Dances with Wolves, because they really get into the tradition. And so all of these, it's like all, you're allowed to defend tradition and honor and hierarchical societies as long as it isn't European. As long as it isn't white, you're allowed to do that. In fact, you'll be celebrated for it. And of course, you've got the added extra where it is like a kind of Western mechanized society, which is about to annihilate this noble honor culture. But you're allowed to look at it in those terms, or you're allowed to look at it like in Dances with Wolves, when it's these kind of sleazy looking cowboys and red legs and all of this coming across, and they're all drunkards, and they're all like greasy and ugly. You're allowed to hate them, and you're allowed to hate the fellow on Avatar who drinks his coffee and does all of that from the helicopter thing. So it is kind of tedious. It is kind of the same movie being repackaged over and over again. And what's in contrast, you can look at some of the Chinese cinema. We've never covered one of these movies, but if you look at something like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Hero, it's actually really quite beautiful, because you can say it's just Chinese propaganda or whatever. And maybe it's even a little bit commercialized by Hollywood. But the fact is, you see in those films a kind of perfect nationalistic propaganda. The women are beautiful and feminine, and it's about deep roots and morality, and absolutely thoroughly Chinese. And the aesthetics and everything are wonderful. But again, it's all very Chinese. I'd like to have that for Britain. I'd like to see how that would be in a British version of that, which actually celebrates our culture and our people in the way that they can do. But all you get is Dances with Avatar and the last, and God knows what they're making now. I just kind of checked out. But all right. What we got there? Somebody, at best, your last hours on this earth will be nightmares from all the garbage they stuffed into your brain. You let them. movies has been applied to eradicate you since the... Oh, shut up, you prick. What a load of bullshit.
Can I just say one thing, Morgoth? If anyone likes Gallipoli and they want to watch another film about the Australians in World War One, can I recommend The Light Horseman, which has got the best cavalry charge ever filmed in it? So if you enjoyed Gallipoli, go and check out The Light Horseman. It's actually a better story. It's also a true story. Because it's successful. It isn't unsuccessful.
All right. Any parting shots? What you got planned for next month, Endeavor?
So we're not going to be doing Dances with Wolves, but I'm thinking of doing another Kevin Costner movie, and one that's a bit topical for the world today. I'm thinking of doing 13 Days, the movie about the Cuban.
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, that's a good film. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great one. I like that movie. That's and quite topical as well. I will say, though, that Kevin Costner's starting to sort of get up into the rankings.
Mel Gibson, too. Yeah.
Mel Gibson as well. How many Mel Gibson films? This will be four because we did all three Mad Maxes.
Have we done any of his other ones? I can't think off the top of my head. With Kevin Costner, we've done The Highwaymen. We've done...
We did Mutiny on the Bounty, didn't we?
That wasn't Kevin Costner, though.
It was Mel Gibson, though.
We did the 1960s version of Mutiny on the Bounty. He was in the 80s one. But, I mean, that might actually have been a better version. Maybe we should have done that one. But I think we've done The Untouchables, and we've done... it was Highwayman, Untouchables, and I think there must have been one more, but I can't think of it off the top of my head. This will probably be our third or fourth.
Kevin Costner's competing with Charlton Heston.
He's getting up there, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next month. Don't forget, you can find all my stuff on Substack. I never plug the Substack on these streams. I'm a terrible e-celeb, like. All right. Cheers, folks. Catch you later.